So, Wynne Hughes is our neighbor. And this is her first time speaking at Many Rivers Books and Tea. She has an office just upstairs. She is a psychotherapist and the author of this book, Life is the Ceremony, with a fantastic title, Life is the Ceremony, How We Live It is the Ritual, the Journey of a Feminine Shaman. And I don't know as much about Wynne as I hope to know by the end of the evening. So I think, having said that, I will ask you to join me in thanking her for coming and speaking at Many Rivers tonight, and let her get on with it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. And this is being recorded. Are you all okay with that? In case you share, or okay. Thanks for that introduction. I have an office upstairs. As I read, you may hear me mention Taos, New Mexico, because about a year and a half ago, I moved here, back to California, from there, a place that, as we say sometimes in our lives, I will never leave. And I was there for 14 years, and my soul feels most at home there, and I never thought I'd ever leave, ever. But here I am. And so if I reference Taos as my home, I'm here. So I thought of starting. I have a number of things I can read, and we can talk as we go and talk again at the end. And rather than tell you a bit about myself, the introduction to the book called In the Beginning describes my life and basically why I wrote this book. So I thought I'd start there and read some of that. And I apologize for scratchy throat. I lost my voice a week or so ago, and it's just back. So I may stop and drink some tea or talk low, but please let me know if you can't hear me. Okay. As a child, I felt as though I had awakened from a deep sleep to find myself in a new world, a place that seemed foreign to me, very different from where I had last been. While I didn't know where last was, I did know without a doubt that when I looked up into the stars at night, I was looking homeward. I knew I was a part of all things, the heavens, the animals, all of life, and the natural world around me. My life has been an unusual journey, a dance between this physical world and the vast spiritual world of interdimensional realities and planes of consciousness. My earliest memories are of feeling that my experience of life was noticeably different from the experiences of others around me. I grew up on a typical block in Brooklyn, which meant that on most days the natural world available to me for exploration was limited to a small, really small, patch of dirt and shrubs in front of our apartment building. I spent many hours kneeling to reach through that chain-link fence surrounding that small garden, observing and touching as much of the soil as I could get my hands on. I studied the insects, the plants, everything that existed in that tiny microcosm, occasionally risking the wrath of the landlord who had declared the garden off-limits, by climbing over the fence and sitting in the garden. I longed for my family's periodic outings to the country, where I felt more at home than anywhere else. But since these outings were infrequent, I spent as much time as possible playing in the mountains, rivers, and miles of open land that existed in my inner magical realm. Some of the most glorious times of my childhood were the summers I spent with my aunt and uncle at their house in Long Island with my cousins, April and Gerard. We reveled in the freedom to roam the countryside on our own. Returning to Brooklyn after a summer there was always very difficult. As soon as I could, at age 20, I left the city and moved to the mountains of Southern California. I have lived on or near the mountains ever since. In the mountains, I feel more at peace with myself, most connected to my earth mother and to spirit. This is where I soar. I was blessed with intellectual curiosity and an unshakable spiritual awareness that has been the consistent inner landscape of my life. Out-of-body experiences, mystical visions, and the ability to communicate with non-embodied beings, some of whom I will introduce to you in this book, were commonplace. During one of my first meetings with a particular group of beings, they revealed my soul's purpose, referring to me as an interdimensional translator. I asked them what in the world they meant by that, and they answered, It is not of the world, it is between the worlds, translating between the worlds. In this lifetime, they explained, I would integrate the knowledge and perspectives I received from my mystical and visionary experiences and develop the ability to translate the information from the cosmic dialect into the language of the physical plane. In other words, I was to translate from the mystical and spiritual realms into this realm that dominates our consciousness here on Earth. They emphasized how essential it was for me to live in alignment with the natural laws of creation, as they are mirrored by the sacred wheel's teachings of all that is in nature, cycles, seasons, the elements, and the spiritual truths as they are explained today by what we refer to as quantum theory. I was to translate this information into simple, practical, accessible terms. This is a tall order for anyone, much less for a kid from Brooklyn. But when they spoke, there was no doubt as to the truth they were speaking. It resonated deeply within me from a place beyond time and beyond mind. There have always been individuals whose vision of realities reaches far beyond the constructs and paradigms of their time. They travel to other dimensions and planes of reality and return like pathfinders to tell us of the new realityscapes. I've always known that I am one of these explorers. I remember the day that one of my spiritual teachers showed me my soul's purpose in the Akashic Records, the celestial realm where all and everything is recorded. I was shown my responsibility to return with stories of the spirit world. I've lived a blessed life, personally and professionally, in spite of some early choices and personal challenges which threw interesting boulders and bends into the river of my life, including becoming a mother at age 15. I was a natural mother, taking on the role, and life changes joyfully and energetically. The level of responsibility at such a young age never felt heavy. Instead, it was light and felt right for me. It wasn't until I was 27 years old that the strain of doing so much in life at once, raising myself while raising my children, putting myself through college and graduate school, and the basic realities of physical survival came crashing down. I was exhausted and felt so much older than my years. I divorced and struggled as a single parent for many years. I contemplated often why I had chosen such a difficult path. As my life has unfolded, I've come to understand the blessing that young parenthood provided me. Astrologically, I'm an Aquarius with not one aspect of Earth in my chart. I am mostly air. Given the experiences you are about to read, I believe I would have floated away like a helium balloon had I not experienced the radical grounding of parenthood and the responsibilities that come with it at such an early age. It gave me the footing to tether myself as I traveled beyond the borders of this world. For over 30 years, I've been a licensed counselor, providing therapy and transpersonal counseling and coaching, as well as a Reiki master, a minister priestess, and a teacher. I co-founded a healing center with other medical and holistic professionals. I taught in a few colleges, hosted radio shows, produced conferences, and was a massage therapist. My passions are writing and music, expressing my heart and enjoying the healing nature of sound and word. In earlier times, I sold cosmetics at Macy's in Manhattan. I really did. And I owned various businesses, a cleaning service, a leather shop, a cafe, and a gallery. While in New York, in college, as a struggling single mother on welfare, I ran an anatomy and physiology lab. Few other colorful jobs filled out that list. Back then, I wanted to be a performer, a singer. I was originally a theater major in college, until the responsibilities of single parenting made it impossible to participate in the required evening and weekend rehearsals and performances scheduled. I was brokenhearted. Instead, I chose to be a psychotherapist. I felt there wasn't anything that called me besides music that had meaning to me. Over 3 decades, I've integrated my spiritual experiences with my professional work. Blending the two together was essential, though I often found myself asking, where does a feminine shaman fit on my resume? So that's who I am. Any thoughts about that, or any one of you have similar experiences, or?
Well, I was struck by you saying you had an unshakable belief through childhood, through adolescence, through, through it all, there was never a doubt.
No.
That's great.
No, I doubted myself. I doubted this world. I doubted probably everything else. You know, I grew up in the 60s, so everything was up for grabs. You know, I was a pretty radical, wild teenager. Obviously, if I had my first child at 15, I started everything really fast and furious. But I came in with that awareness, and it was the only thing that I had that was unshakable. Literally the only thing.
I found experience for myself and some other women that it's the adolescence that brings the doubt of those experiences of childhood. And it's a very difficult time.
One of the things I talk about in another chapter, which I'm not going to read from, is about soul purpose, and that there are times in life when soul purpose arises to call us and remind us what we're here to do, and adolescence, I believe, is one of them. You know, I experienced it, and I experienced it with my clients and the kids that I worked with. I used to be an administrator of three different residential facilities for teens in California, Southern California, in Monterey area, actually. And I saw it over and over again that teenagers have this inner sense of knowing what they're supposed to do if they're allowed to experiment and try things on. But usually it's the adults, us in the world, who say, no, you need to learn a skill, you need to learn how to survive, and we squelch that often. And they react and rebel to anything that squelches that, typically. And I see it arise again in what we would call midlife crisis, which to me is just a midlife call, saying, are you doing what you needed to do? Are you here doing it? And if not, take a look. Where have you been? Where are you now? Where do you want to go? Are you happy? What the hell's going on? So I do see that in teenagers, that they question those things and question everything. But it is in one of the chapters in the book that I'm not going to read about, but now you know it's in there. Yeah. Any other thoughts before I move on?
Okay. I mean, it seemed like you did such diverse jobs. How did you prepare yourself for all those, that variety? You just went for it?
I had to survive. People ask me that a lot. I had a friend once say to me, oh, you're so full of shit, you couldn't possibly have done all of that. She wasn't a close friend, just someone I knew. And I was like, oh, I really did. And more. And I think it was survival. You know, I had to get through school. I had to survive. I had children to take care of. I had to do a little bit of everything to get through while I was in graduate school. And you just do what you have to do. And I was blessed with that unshakable knowing about life. So I really know in my heart of hearts that unshakable spiritual center is what kept me going. I knew I was here for something other than being the welfare mother in the tenement in Brooklyn. You know, I had terrible grief when I left. I felt like a survivor guilt. Mm-hmm. I left people I knew that I knew would probably be there forever. You know, a long time. And then I felt like I was escaping it. But truly, I was just creating another reality. I was unwilling to accept that as my permanent reality. And most young people don't have that kind of determination that I did. I don't recommend being a parent at 15. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, there were other options. Mm-hmm. For me, it worked. And like I said, I think doing that kept me tethered to the earth, because I'm literally all air. There isn't one bit of earth in me. Now there is. Now I teach earth-based traditions.
So, were you hoping to talk more about the book, or can I ask questions about what you're doing?
Yeah, I'm going to read a bunch of the book.
Okay.
Yeah, and so yeah, you can ask questions as we go, after I finish, and I'm going to bounce around depending upon how much time we have or where we go. I may read a lot of it, I may read not.
Okay.
But yeah, did you have a question right now?
I guess my question was, like, what's your focus now? Like, how are you focusing your energies now? Are you working with people individually, one-on-one,
yeah,
groups? Or?
I talk about in the here, because I talk about being a psychotherapist a lot, and things like how schizophrenia relates to the mystical state. And I'm not going to read that now. But I do, right now I focus on people who are very motivated and do life coaching. I did not renew my license in California, which was the first license I had about 35, 37 years ago. I just do, I have a program called Highest Good Coaching, so I help people to manifest and create what they want in their lives. And I'm a Reiki master, so I do integrative work as well, and I write books, and I do music. I co-write with my husband and manage his rock and roll band. You know, so I sneak that into the back door. But yeah, and I have a brochure and cards here that kind of describes some of the work that I do upstairs.
Great, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm totally. I have an office upstairs.
Oh, literally.
Yeah, I do. Literally upstairs. Did you know how high did you think I was talking?
Real high.
Real high.
How's the rent?
Okay. The book is divided into two sections. One, the first part is called the ceremony, and the second part is called the ritual. And basically what that is for me is that our lives, just being here, is the ceremony. And we were all invited, we all signed on, you know, to show up here. And it's this, you know, gala, amazing event that we're here all to share. And that's the ceremony and the celebration of it all. But the ritual is how we choose to live our lives. And I have parts of the book where I talk a lot about ritual and ceremony. And the ritual is often, you know, repeated actions or words that transform and shift consciousness in some way. And that's the part we have choice about, is how we actually design the ritual. Every word that comes out of our mouth, every action we choose to take, is the ritual in this big ceremony that we're all in. And we all design different rituals. But this book is about designing your life as a ritual of awakening and expanding consciousness and living your sacred path and really being conscious and aware of all the elements around us and literally how we breathe and how we walk and how we move and every word and every intention. And in designing the ritual, how to manifest and create what we want in this world by aligning with the natural laws of creation, which are what you see reflected in quantum physics. They're described here in this book as well. And also aligning with the seasons and what you might call the sacred wheel or medicine wheels. And I have an eclectic... I'm going to talk about that. We'll read about that in a little bit. This chapter is... it's actually chapter one. It's called Becoming a Spiritual Revolutionary. And the revolutionary is hyphened. It's R-evolutionary. It's a program that I created. And... I will describe exactly what that means. Start in the middle of the page. Translating these very cosmic laws into a path of living is not a complex process. Anyone can experience this by practicing simple conscious choices, intentions, and actions. What we envision is what we place into the creative field. It becomes what is materialized. If it exists within us, we can project it through frequency and energetic wave, through our own inner projector of creation. Werner Erhard, the founder of S, said, "Say it enough times and it becomes truth in the universe." Place it out there into vibration and the creative field will respond. When what we want to create does not appear quickly enough to satisfy our expectations, we sometimes begin to lose faith. As soon as we doubt, that feeling of doubt is projected out into the creative field and changes the original energetic wave of creation that we intended. The wave going out into creative law is no longer the pure one we started with. It is important to understand how creative intention can yield something that often looks so different from what we consciously intended. Imagine for a moment the simplistic analogy of working with paint. We all can relate to that. The paint can is our life. The white base paint is our creative or unified field. We want to create love, and love is the color deep pink. We begin by adding to that white paint a few drops of red paint into that white field. Each time we place red drops of love into the field, the paint becomes pinker. If the process feels too slow, we become frustrated and doubt the field of white paint will ever become visibly pink. I say visibly because creation already exists on the unseen levels before it's visible to our physical eyes and registers in our direct experience. Let's say that our frustration and doubt is the frequency of blue. Now remember, we're putting pink in the white can, red in the white can, because our intention is to get pink. So let's say our frustration and doubt is the frequency of blue. Immediately, because we're frustrated now, it's not happening quick enough, immediately we feel frustrated and the color blue gets added to the can of paint. And the pink turns purple. Purple paint is the creation we did not intend. Because consciously, we only added red drops to the paint. Now we really become doubtful that we will ever see deep pink. We begin to feel out of control. More of the blue color now, of that vibration of doubt, is added to the mix and the paint turns a new shade yet again. Each time we consciously or unconsciously add doubt, fear, or any emotion or thought that is counter to the original intention, it changes what we are bringing into form. We have placed many frequencies into the unified creative field in addition to the one we originally wanted. And we have created something we believe we did not intend. We cannot figure out how this happened. We're baffled. When we take full responsibility for our nature as creator source, we begin to see every action, word, emotion, thought as a drop or color added to our can of white paint, or in creation terms, as energetic waves added to our creative field. When this conscious process is understood, our lives become very closely aligned with the natural laws of creation governing this process. The more we practice living and acting with this level of awareness, the more we are able to consciously create what we intend. I'm frequently asked by clients and students wanting to live their lives consciously in today's world, what can I do with my life? What is this all about? Where is the meaning? My answer to them is simple. It's not about surviving. It's about waking up. Waking up is a lifelong commitment to spiritual evolution. It's a revolutionary act, a spiritually political act that changes the status quo of our lives, our culture, our country, and our world. It requires that we stop living a life designed to keep us preoccupied with physical survival and comfort, and start embracing a life in alignment with our own highest nature and creative law. We stop living as if physical survival is all there is. We remember who we really are and what is possible. There's just one more piece to add here, and we'll stop. Well, I might skip that part. How might our lives be different if we committed more time to the experience of love and to developing and navigating the frequencies of conscious spiritual awareness? Realistically, our physical survival warrants our time and attention. However, when it dominates and becomes the defining aspect of our lives, we live out of balance with the vibration of expanded planes of consciousness and spirit. The busyness becomes a lifestyle that prevents us from finding periods of stillness to tune in. Just one more piece here. Here is a point to ponder. If spiritual evolution is a threat to the status quo of government, which I believe it is, to the status quo of government that values political and financial dominance above all else, we support this with the dense frequencies we tend to transmit and receive in waking consciousness, which I like to refer to as Channel 4. What if instead we received Channel 7? Which is broadcasting the message that we are all one with spirit, nature, and one another. Imagine the spiritual, personal, and political implications for us all. Consider how threatening the expansion of consciousness is to the present consensual political mindset and control. I propose that if we awaken to the oneness of all things, to the interconnectedness of all life and physical form, we will no longer be able to passively watch while another aspect of our own self goes hungry, is murdered, lives without health care, is homeless, or in any way suffers. If we truly understand that we are all one, if we understand that there is no spiritual distinction between self and other, we will not wage war on our own homes or our own bodies. We will actually require, even demand, a peaceful existence in this world. All we have to do is expand our reception and transmission of consciousness and awaken to the programs on Channel 7 or any of the other unlimited channels available to us. The broadcast is eternally playing on the cosmic waves, calling us home to our true nature of being. We can create a life designed to expand our ability to consciously receive and transmit on multiple frequencies, encompassing other planes of reality and spirit realms, making the wisdom of the ancients accessible to us all. It's as easy as turning on the news. Every word we utter, every action we take, every choice we make, every minute of life we spend, every breath we take is an energetic transmission of our creative intent. Each new moment is a new opportunity. We have direct creative control of the intent we place into the natural laws of creation. We are the director, the producer, the actor, and the audience. The content of this play, the script, is ours to design. And the higher the frequency that we can receive and transmit, the more incredible and spiritually conscious that creation will be. We must, each of us, step up to the call to be spiritual revolutionaries. Radio Free Spirit is broadcasting right now. And in the book, I describe the precepts of what it means to be a spiritual revolutionary and live that way. There's a web page and a Facebook for Spiritual Revolutionary, though the web page is just being processed. Thoughts on that? Your experience of living, your experience of being that master of your life, or being aware of every breath you take, every sound, every word, and the implications for life if we actually embrace that. Because I watch myself every day not. And, you know, at the end of the day, I always look back and say, how good was I doing that today? How asleep was I? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, more often than I'd like to admit, I slept a lot. But there are some times when I don't sleep. There are some times when I'm awake. And I'm very aware of the difference in the quality of my life in terms of bringing forth that which I want to intend and create, in making sure that I put red paint into the white paint so I get the pink I intended, rather than all these fears and you know, broadcasting on Channel 4, which is the insanity of what we have. You know, then I get purple and half the time I get brown or black. I don't get pink at all. So any thoughts you have about that and want to share? I'm not the only one that wakes up asleep, am I?
I find that there is a practice, it's an ongoing process, right? Practice being aware, because we do fall asleep, and we have our lives that we live, and whatever we've created in our lives, we feel responsibility for it. We have our story around that, and that's a really powerful thing. And so I find it easy to get caught up in that current of flow of life, and if I don't take the time and will that space. That I don't have that red paint available to put into the mix. And then when I find that I do have that time, and I see the benefit of it, and I see that each one of my actions does have an effect, probably on the collective consciousness in the world. That ripples out. I believe in that too. Energetic quality there. So it's not insignificant, but it seems really small in the daily time, daily activity or experience. So yeah, I just want to acknowledge that. I guess honor that it's an ongoing process of trying to be aware more and more. Because it's so easy to slip into
the system. And when I work with high school coaching, I have, and I do this for myself all the time, a yardstick. And on the yardstick, I have the physical world that you want to manifest in the inner world, what you want to cultivate inside, and those choice points where we either have red paint or we go to brown and add, or those choice points of, am I going to be awake in this moment or not? Am I going to obsess and be stressed or, you know, crazy about something in this moment, or am I going to sit in the silence for 5 minutes and remain clear? And I do this in my life, and this is part of my work, is each decision gets measured against this yardstick of what my intention is. Every single decision. Will it move me closer to this or not? Will it move me to the silence or not? Will it move me towards pink paint or blue? So that every choice point is a conscious choice point, because most of the time we make them asleep. We go on default, like the font on your computer. You know, if you don't choose what font it is, there's a default font. I call it universal default. If we don't consciously create our lives, well, we have a universal default. You know? So, yeah, it is a practice, and it's an ongoing practice.
I've experienced and know people who are spiritually very open that it takes a long time to deal with being too sensitive to energy, mm-hmm. to people's energies, to suffering and sorrow that comes in. And I love what Thich Nhat Hanh said. He says, you don't have to keep your windows open all the time. just to know yourself well enough, I can't actually be totally open at this point. I do need to shut my windows right now. And that's a hard thing to learn.
It is. And what helped me, this story's not in the book, when I was first out of graduate school, like a ridiculously long time ago, I came out pretty egoic and righteous. I was going to help humanity and save the world and do all these great things because now I was a therapist. And I really thought I was somebody being a therapist. And I went to a psychic that a friend brought me to ask her about my future and what was going to happen, like these great things I was going to do in the world. And she was a caricature of herself, I swear. This was Fontana, California, in this dingy apartment. She opens the door, and she was this renowned psychic. And her hair, she was like the cartoon. Her hair was in curlers, and she smoked. She had smoked like this, and talked like that. And she had a friggin' poodle in her arm. It was amazing. So I walk in, I can't remember her first name. Anyway, and I told her of these amazing things I was going to do, and I expected I was going to get, you know, such praise and all of that, and I got I didn't. And what she basically said to me was, if I can do it without scratching my throat, how arrogant of you. Like that. I was shocked. I was just like completely, my bubble was popped. Mm. How arrogant of you to think it's your place to take away anyone's lessons. The best thing you can do is to learn to get out of their way. And whoa. And then she talked with me about the healing and taking people's energy on, and that the best thing you can do is to be present with someone and to hear them and to mirror back to them. But that ultimately they were here to learn their lessons. And if you get in their way and think you're going to save anyone or really do anyone's work for them, you are interfering with their progress, and you'd better, honey, get out of their way. Whoa. And that changed my world to hear that, because she was so right. Mm-hmm. You know, so right. But we do have to take care of ourselves. You know, in the process of, I'm very sensitive to energies. You know, I grew up in New York City. It's intense there. Yeah, and so sometimes it's like this, and sometimes it's like this. And we have to learn, you know, to do both. I sat with the Dalai Lama once, and he expressed that in a different way. He answered everything in this private meeting, a small group of us, with, as a Buddhist, as a human. So in the Buddhist mode, we're in a compassionate heart, we're present, it's like this. As a human, sometimes it's like this. Thoughts? Yeah.
I've been exploring, I guess, for many years, what I call the spirituality of conversation. And it begins with acknowledging that at every moment, everything is talking back and forth to everything else. And the challenge is to, how do I find my way into that, into the larger conversation? And I've been looking at the role of words and the role of silence and the dance that they do with each other, and how word dominance can cause an imbalance in the conversation. But I'm looking for, always looking for a balanced conversational life inside of myself. And hungering for that in the world, balanced conversation. To me, peace is a balanced conversation. War is an imbalanced conversation. So the challenge is always. So I've been looking at sign language as a way of bringing more silence into the space between me and other people as we do that conversational dance. But looking at everything as conversation has it's almost like conversation is a higher category now for me than spirituality. Do you see where I'm going?
Well, if I understand, you know, what you're saying about conversation, I mean, conversation to me is the way we interact with life.
Yes.
It's our relationship.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so you're describing an aware, conscious relationship within yourself and how that manifests and relates to the world.
Absolutely.
That's how I took that. Yeah. And it's interesting that you said sign language, because for 8 years I was in relationship with a man who was deaf, completely deaf, and I thought I knew silence. Oh, my God. It was amazing to see how he lived without the distraction. He had his own inner distractions, a lot of them, his own demons, but he didn't have the outer distractions. And sometimes I'd be envious, because he could have absolute silence. He could turn it all off. And the language, sign language, was a beautiful expression, which I found very difficult to learn.
Well, I came up with a few of my own signs. This sign means pause. And it's really useful. If I love being paused, and like if someone wants to think about something or process something maybe that was just said, or maybe they're feeling crowded by words. It taught me something. Suddenly I had a new dimension in my inner dialogue and in my conversation with everyone else, just because it was one of the signs for pause. And so I entered into this new space, which was not dominated and defined by words anymore. And it helped.
Yeah, I could
enormously.
See that. Thanks. I'll read a little bit more. I'm going to jump to, where are we on time?
10 after 8.
Okay. I'm going to jump to one of the visions. The chapters where I sort of talk about different teachings and things are interspersed with various visions. And some of these visions, as I describe in the introduction, there's a lot of visions. Some of them are meeting beings, some of them are shifting to different dimensions. One that I won't read is called Parallel Worlds, where I experienced two different levels, parallel realities, overlapped like a double exposure. I could see them both at the same time. That was rather fascinating. I was aware of that one, but that one wasn't aware of me. So I'm going to read one called The Grandfathers, and I'll read this one because the grandfathers are probably the teachers and beings whom I've had the most contact with and consistently still do. I find the California coast one of the most beautiful stretches of coastline in the United States. I resonate deeply with the spirit and energy of that area, and it proved to be very conducive to my navigation of expanded states of consciousness. Living in Carmel Valley, just miles north of the powerful Big Sur coast, allowed me daily access to this magical land, with its mountains running alongside the intense energy and rhythms of the ocean waves. One day I was hiking with friends in Palo Colorado Canyon, a place where I frequently hiked in a trance-like walking meditation, matching each breath with my steps. My friends had gone ahead, as they often did when I was walking at such a slow, even pace. Out of nowhere, this was the first time they ever appeared to me, out of nowhere, a panel of 13 beings appeared before me. They materialized simultaneously in front of me and above me. Enormous, larger-than-life beings measuring at least 30 feet or more in size. They were big. I was so startled, I stopped in my tracks. I immediately was overcome with a familiar sense of universal love and compassion for myself and all that existed. My heart was blown wide open, slowly dissolving into the love that surrounded me. I was being loved. I was giving love. I was love. I began to cry deep, deep tears, as I often do when my heart opens completely, as it was then. The beings were clothed in hooded robes, which in the moment struck me as sort of corny cosmic cliché. But over the years, I have met numerous non-embodied beings who present to humans in this hooded fashion. When I focused on these 13 beings, I noticed they appeared to have physical form, though not of the dense matter we could expect physical beings to have. I could actually see through them to the trees and mountainside behind them. "We are the grandfathers," they said softly. "We've been with you all of your life, though this is the first time we are allowing you to see us." I wondered why they chose to appear to me then, and they immediately replied, "Because you're ready." They seemed to be chuckling as they said this, as if I was the only one who did not see the obvious. I was curious as to why they called themselves the grandfathers. Why not the grandfathers and grandmothers? Were they all men? They didn't seem to be male, yet they didn't seem to be female either. Sensing my confusion, they explained to me that they were androgynous, neither male nor female. They existed in a dimension of reality where the polarity of gender held no meaning or purpose. I suddenly realized I had not asked that question, nor the previous one, out loud. And yet they had heard me, as if telepathically. I knew this was possible because I had experienced it before during visionary meetings with other non-embodied beings, and also on more than one occasion with the man who was my husband at an earlier period of my life. During medicinal shamanic journeys, we were able to communicate conversations without uttering a word. The grandfathers often communicated telepathically as one being, their 13 minds melded into one voice, speaking one collective message. Yet at other times, they each had a definite singular vibration and spoke separately. I was experiencing merging with others who were dissolved into one collective being, while maintaining the integrity of my own individual nature. To be one with everything and still hold a unique vibration of self was a transformative teaching. I began to see the air glistening as my inner vision became keen enough to perceive the exchange of energy between particles and along energy waves. The phenomenon resembles swirling rainbows on a surface of bubbles as they sparkle. I had seen it before in ecstatic states, so the sparkling light was comforting and soothing, as was being in the presence of these beautiful beings. With this level of awareness, energy is very visible on the physical and inner eye. Even the energy exchange between the tiniest of particles and the most ethereal aspects of material form. This light show was always a welcome delight, and on that particular day, I remember, I was very distracted by the dancing of colorful swirls, dots, and geometric patterns. I had to make a concerted effort to get out from behind my eyes, a term I will explain in a subsequent chapter, and allow the information being transmitted from the grandfathers to be all that I focused on. The grandfathers always instructed by lifting the veil of illusion, enabling me to experience directly what they came to teach. On this first visit, they wanted me to understand that all aspects of life are one, connected, yet each holds a unique vibration. They revealed to me that when the physical form dies, the persona as we know it fades, but the unique vibration of self, beyond the specifics of any one particular lifetime, continues. I can barely describe in words the incredible comfort and peace this awareness brings. Before that first visit, I knew that I continued beyond this form, but it was this lesson that enabled me to experience directly the unique vibrational aspect of my individual nature that remains after this form is released, and the physical and personal self is gone. The grandfathers wanted me to know that my own nature was infinite, and that there is only one infinite connective being, and how devastating it is for humanity that we have forgotten this and live in the illusion of separateness. As they communicated, the energy emanating from them changed and became heavier. I heard their warning that if we as a people did not wake up to this truth, our survival was at risk. They communicated this with absolute concern and enormous compassion for us all. They love us as grandparents love a grandchild and worries for their safety. We remained in a communal embrace that day for what felt like an entire afternoon, but turned out to be only 30 minutes. When they knew I had understood and integrated all that they had imparted to me, the collective consciousness shifted. My own unique vibration became stronger, and their embrace was released. They gave me what felt like an invisible, infinite hug and promised to return again. I cried as their presence faded. I was changed. The woman who had entered Palo Canyon that day was gone, and a new version was present in her place. I won't continue on with that one. Have any of you ever seen spiritual beings? I ask because often people have, and you know, sometimes they think they're crazy, and people look at them like they're nuts, but I know I'm not alone.
I once had a partner, and she was always seeing angels, and the look on her face would be so transformed and transfixed that I really wished I could see what she saw.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
I don't experience it seeing experiences. I just experience them in vision.
You sense them?
In visionary, yeah, and hear things in visionary states. And sometimes, and some of those beings come back with more lessons than her.
Yeah.
But it is a very important, I mean, and as a child, I was always hearing voices and instructing me, and yeah, I knew I was from the stars, and I could get out of my body and watch myself play, you know, and all those, and astral travel and all those things. Of course, I was smart enough not to tell anybody.
Yeah.
Because I know other girls who did and were medicated or put in psychiatric wards.
Yeah.
So, I mean, later on I found out.
Yeah.
So I think it's really important that people speak their truth and speak that experience.
Yeah. There are a number of things. Let's see. Time-wise, what should I read?
I find walking in the woods and stuff. I think that's it for me. It starts with my own mental stuff, thoughts, and everything. And then at a certain point, it'll kind of shift. And then it's like really good information coming in.
And it's important that we listen.
Yeah.
You know, and not doubt those things. Because some people hear, they don't see at all. You know, they hear voices, they hear direction. And some people see.
I don't see, but my art always has.
Oh, you're an artist.
And figures and. What did you say? Where they don't have a body, but.
Disembodied.
Disembodied entity, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, have they visited you since then?
Yes, actually, about 6 weeks ago was the last time I was hit by a car while walking in a parking lot. And I have this particular voice. I'm going to read just two more pieces and I'll stop. But I have this particular voice that I hear, and I don't know who it is. They never say who they are, but it's a particular voice that gives me directives a lot, very authoritative. And I was walking in the parking lot and this car just hit me and everything went into slow motion. And as I was thrown into the air, landed on the hood, and started sliding down in front of the car, ended up, it was like wham, bam, choo, like that. That's about how fast it was. Slow motion, that voice appeared. And because I looked and went, oh, there's a car in my side. And then I was thrown up onto the hood, and I began to slide down to the front of the car. And this voice, that same voice, said, "Wind," just like that. "If you continue down the front, you're going to go under the car, honey. So tuck and roll and throw yourself to the right." And I said, "Okay." And I did, but it was that fast. And I was injured. But that was the last time I heard that voice. It comes often. The grandfathers haven't been around for a while, but I also haven't asked them. You know, it's an amazing thing. If we ask and pay attention and ask, they will appear. I haven't asked them for quite a while. I have other beings and other experiences and dimensions that I cultivate and do. There's two things I want to read. I don't know if I'll read it all, and then we can just talk some more. Keeping quiet about things because you're afraid of what people will say. The first book I wrote went really fast. It's called Daughters of the Moon, Sisters of the Sun, and it's empowering women and peace between the genders. And this book started then, and it stopped, and that was like 18 years ago or so. And I know why, because I needed to have a lot more experiences to put in here. And the book's a lot smaller than it originally was going to be, because there are other books I'm working on now. But one of the chapters in here is on the use of sacred medicine. You know, and that can be peyote or mushrooms or different empathogens or LSD or whatever your particular medicine of choice might be, but how they're used in other cultures and how I've used them in my life. And I struggled with keeping that chapter in because about 5.5 years ago, this January, I was in court testifying on behalf of my daughter who was in a custody battle because she had had a DUI and her ex was trying to get custody. And so it was all in question and she couldn't see her son without a supervisor until they proved whether she presently was drinking. And I applied to be the supervisor when I came to visit. And I had to go to court because I was subpoenaed because my son-in-law brought up my use of medicines. And so here I was on the stand with the judge just drilling me and the prosecuting attorney pulling up my website and literally copying the pages of my website and throwing them on the judge's table saying, "Drumming circles! Drumming circles! Women's ritual!" And it was a witch burning. And the drug use came up. You know, in the courts it's called a drug. To me it's a medicine. And so I was terrified and horrified, and I was investigated and had to interrogated, and I was said to not be an appropriate supervisor for my grandson when the question is whether his mother is drinking, because someone who has done medicinals is likely to condone alcohol abuse. So I was terrified, and I withdrew this chapter on medicines. I'm like, oh, shit, what do I do? And the question came up, who we were all different ways talking about speaking your truth. And I said, I can't leave this out. Like, there's no way to leave this out because it's an important part of life. And I can't respond to the fear because that's putting blue paint in the red paint. And I'm going to get friggin' purple and what I want is pink. And so I struggled with it. And so I took out a couple of sentences that I thought might implicate me poorly in a court of law if ever I ended up there again. Take it out a lot. And so I will read you this part. A small piece of the chapter, which is in the part called Feminine Shaman. And this is one of the things I wasn't sure if I was going to put in, and it's about doing LSD with my son. It's in a part about life experiences and how challenging and choosing to use medicines and navigating the layers of consciousness with skill. I teach navigational skills in this life and in those levels because there's layers and levels that are darkness and we don't want to get stuck there. We want to be able to move and navigate like one would navigate a sailboat through these dimensions. I'll skip this part where I'm just talking about when my kids were small, I felt that it was my responsibility to teach them how to awaken. Not just learn what to do to have a job or things like that, but to awaken. And that's a huge responsibility that I felt. My kids became teenagers and experimented with substances. and struggled with their own inner direction for search and meaning. One afternoon, my son, who at the time was 19 years old, came to me and asked, "Mom, I want to have a spiritual experience like the ones you talk about. I want to find meaning in my life. Would you do medicine with me and guide me?" That's exactly what I did. I was surprised because at the time he was a pretty conservative young man, driven by the pursuit of money and status, a pre-med student at a local university. This request brought me to the forefront of my entire belief system and commitment to my own inner values and paradigm of reality. I thought it over for a while, considering my son and his sincere wish for meaning, and also my frustration with our culture's lack of safe, elder-guided opportunities for such experiences. My answer was yes, but only under one condition. He was to first cultivate navigational tools so that he would have enough mastery to be able to move through the doors of perception and not become stuck in the magnified levels of the human mind, psyche, and conditioning. He agreed. I instructed him in the simple breathing technique, which I describe in Chapter 7, that would enable him to channel and move energy and navigate the layers. He also practiced basic meditation techniques so he would not get lost in his thoughts, which I knew would be intense, but instead to confidently remain centered in his locus of being, not following the myriad of thoughts and emotions that appear and distract us from our center of being is a necessary skill. There wasn't a lot of time since he was at the threshold of some important life choices, and he wanted what he hoped would be a new perspective and understanding prior to making these choices. As soon as he seemed to have a modicum of skills, we set the date for our journey together. When the day came, we were ready. We had prepared by fasting for the previous 24 hours and made sure our home environment was serene, peaceful, and safe. We ingested our medicine, and what followed was about 12 hours of a profound spiritual journey for each of us. My son was successful at pushing beyond the edges of his reality. He witnessed the Akashic levels, where all and everything is recorded, and experienced a direct knowing of the transcendent. He was in a state of godhood, nirvana, samadhi, no mind. He transcended time, transcended his personal identification of self, and experienced his sovereign divine nature. He turned to me at one point, and said, "Mom, you do know that we are not really mother and son, don't you?" We came into this life with a contract to play out these roles together, but I know that it's really not so. We are really one being, he really said this, one spirit here in these two bodies playing these parts. "But don't worry, Mom, when we get back to Earth plane, we can still pretend to be these roles." "I will still pretend to be your son." I told him I understood and I would still pretend to be his mom. We laughed and smiled, knowing a smile of two beings sharing a deep understanding of life and truth. His life changed from that day forward. He found his truth, and the impact of that awakening experience still guides and feeds his life today. He's still my son, and I'm still his mom, even though we both know the truth. I think I'll stop here. I was going to read the last chapter, but I'll leave it for you if you wish to get the book, about using our magic to bring things into life. And one of the things I worked for a year and a day to call in was my husband. I was alone for quite a while at one point, and everyone had moved away, family, friends. I was really alone in Taos. And I had reached the point of just having enough courage to say, "I'm done being alone. I am putting it out to the universe that I'm calling in my partner. I'm ready, and I'm going to humble myself enough to say, I really want this, and I want it." And so I began for a year and a day to do a ritual. And that chapter describes what the ritual was that I did, how I had interventions from guides and beings to have me add things into my ritual, and why they were important in calling Kevin in. And most people find that one of their favorite chapters in the book. But it's important that we align with these laws, creative laws, that we work with the seasons of nature. And there's a book in here, a chapter in here, on the sacred wheel and aligning with the seasons and aligning with the elements and how to utilize those. there's a chapter on ritual, how to manifest and create ritual easily. We don't need to be trained to do that. It's in us. And it's just some guidelines for how to do that, how to create ritual in a very significant, meaningful way. Simple ritual and transcendent, ecstatic ritual, where you actually align with those laws in a powerful way and call things into your life. There's a chapter on altars. There's everything that you could need to align with and work with these laws that I'm talking about is in the second half of this book. I will stop there. Thoughts, questions, sharing to me, please. I'd like to hear more of the things that you experience that are similar.
I don't know if anybody caught Lisa Ling on CNN the other night. She went down to Peru, and there's a shaman down there who offers medicine to people, to come. And so lots of people with, psychiatric type things go there. And, he sets it all up very, ceremonial and everything. And then there was a group of vets that went, and they described their PTSD and the frustration that they get, because at the VA they just get, medication, yeah, that's it, And so the stories were just so touching to her, but it was so interesting to see her kind of like have to kind of make Western sense of what was going on. But the stories were just so touching, it just blew her away.
It can be, when done properly, a very healing experience. Another story I share in the medicine chapter is of a boyfriend of mine way back, long time ago, was diagnosed with cancer and given 3 months to live. He's still alive today, and this is probably about 27 years ago. And part of his healing process was using medicines, along with chemotherapy and some surgeries, but they told him there was no way he was going to live. It just, he was dying. But using medicines in a way, LSD was designed to use in psychiatric hospitals. Ecstasy, in its pure form, not the street form, was used with prisoners and psychiatric patients as a last resort to move them through, and the results of people moving beyond these things and healing is pretty phenomenal. That's how they were originally used, just like peyote rituals and things were used for spiritual healing. The Huichols in Mexico and in Russia, they use different medicines. There are cultures that are used widely.
Oh, I was going to ask, I just have a lot of thoughts running around in my head about, how there's portals, like you were talking about, and possibly part of the way to open the portal is there's all these different ways, maybe, possibly, and some of it might be what you're speaking about, and which is the LSD, so changing our perception, which would be putting it simply, because I have never had that experience. I mean, I've taken LSD, but it wasn't the same kind of experience where I left my body or whatever. So I feel that some people are already kind of experienced in that way. It seems like a lot of people that I've talked to that have these kind of experiences were either maybe more open to it coming in, or they're old souls, or there's so many different ways to look at it.
Well, I think medicine, it's a very individual thing, and it's not essential. There's a breathwork pattern that I use with people all the time, and I use now, which to me is an immediate doorway. And it's using a particular pattern of breathing, and there is a doorway in this pattern. And when you find that doorway in between the inhale and the exhale, and you learn how to cultivate this, it's a doorway. The same way sound can be in other things. And I think medicines are useful when they're guided.
Mm-hmm. So you consider that a medicine? Breath
breathing? Mm-hmm. I consider anything that manifests healing a medicine. That's why I consider those substances a medicine. I don't consider all substances a medicine at all. Some of them are pretty deadly and toxic. But breath work, and this particular thing, what I do when I work with people, one of the things I do is help people shift and teach them some of those navigational tools. This particular breathing pattern, it's described in the book, is one of them. It's really simple. It is so simple, and I actually have been doing it while I'm talking to you. I use it all the time. But to use it with intensity, you can shift and use that to enter the doorway. It's really not that hard when you learn some specific tools. It's really not that difficult. And that's one reason I wrote the book, was to share in a number of different ways, and there's so much in there that I haven't talked about, that these things are right here and accessible. You know, you don't have to go to Peru. So a good friend of mine leads ayahuasca journeys to Peru all the time.
That's what
I figured that's what it was. But you don't have to do substances. You don't have to study different traditions. There are very simple techniques that appear in all traditions when you synthesize it down, that are accessible to us. And in our wisdom, we just have lost access to that, and we don't teach it to each other. We don't have the elders here teaching us these things, you know, guiding us in that way.
I have a question about all that, and also just wanted to share, you know, that I think it is really, it would have really benefited me to have had a guide when I was experimenting with psychedelic drugs. Of course, I was really young, so my conditioning was a lot different than it is today. But I remember that the experience was so impactful, and so many, and a long number of hours, and that I came out of it thinking, I don't know that I'm going to be able to really have conversations with people who've been on these.
Yeah, I understand.
So I felt very, you know, like, oh, I'm in this whole different league now. But, you know, I was only 16 or 17, so I learned how to adjust to the culture again. But what I wanted to say is, you know, now I'm in my 60s, and I'm sort of I'm approaching plant medicine for the second, it's like a whole second wave, but I haven't really, you know, actually had an experience. But I now see, I feel like I'm more grounded, and that I would be able to benefit in a more holistic way. But it isn't that easy to, you know, for someone who's not in the, you know, doesn't know people into it, that to just find your way to it and with a good guide. My other question has to do with, what role has, I mean, so much emphasis in some traditions is put on learning how to meditate and, you know, having that daily attunement. And, I mean, what role do you give that in your practices? I'm just curious.
I do have a whole chapter here on tools,
okay.
Meditation and yoga and nature. Yeah, so I it's a great question. Mm-hmm. There are times in my life when I have had very formal practices, you know, Buddhist traditions, Hindu traditions, you know, Wiccan traditions, and meditation for me, I describe it differently than a lot of Westerners describe traditions. I do not describe meditation, and my experience is not that we sit and stop our thoughts. Mm-hmm. Our thoughts will never stop. We are a computer that's eternal. The actual process for me, as I've experienced it, is the thoughts keep going by, and you identify with a center of being that is not those thoughts. So you learn to cultivate that place that transcends the thought. In Western culture, we talk a lot about stopping the thoughts, and people go crazy. I tried for friggin' years, and I never stopped. I gave up. You don't stop them. They go on. This mental process is an essential tool. But what we do is we learn how to step off the train and watch those words go by to the point where we no longer even hear them. Like a sound outside that you come to the point where you don't hear it, the train whistle, you don't hear it anymore. Words are like that, and emotions are like that. One of the things, the navigational tools I teach, besides how to not
sort of
participate
in
the thoughts.
How to disidentify with them.
Yeah. You just let them go by. You don't, you know, you get on the train, it goes down the track, you just go, here I am, I get off. You don't try and stop the train, it never stops. And same with emotions. They arise and they come. Emotions are a tool, but they can control us and lead us. And, you know, I'm not one for traditional therapy. You know, I've been a therapist now for almost 40 years. I'm 61 in January. And emotions are like that. We have to learn to allow them to arise, to embrace them, to be with them, and let them pass on and not follow them. So emotions and thoughts are very useful tools, but we learn to not live from them. So I have a hard time when people always say, stop your thoughts, because you don't ever. Mm-hmm. You just sort of step back, like out of body, you watch the body, they go on without you.
But you're saying the value is in learning how to, you know, step back.
and become and identify more with that transcendent nature. That
yeah, and at that point, it isn't even an identification. You learn, you know, people use breath, they use light, they use a mantra, whatever it is. That's so that you have a place to go back to. When you work through cultivating that doorway, that place that I said I've had always, there's that spiritual center. You learn to just be quiet and go there, so that these other places are not the places you're living from. You use them when they're useful. And they're always useful. Yeah, they're useful right now. But and you use the breath technique that I describe in here, things like that as tools, but you're living from a place where those things really have no place. And then, you know, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. I mean, that's really true, because nothing in life changes. The only thing that changes is our inner experience of it. And then at choice points, we choose things in alignment with our highest good. When we're at that choice point, we always choose in the direction of aligning with quantum practices and higher cosmic laws. It's time. You have to stop. Look at the book. It's in there. And then I have cards and a brochure here if you have any questions. My email is there.
You know where your office is.
It's upstairs. Suite 203. Please feel free to email me if there's anything I've said that's maybe brought up something and feels unfinished. I'd be happy to email you a response. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much on behalf of Many Rivers.
Thank you.
I want to make a couple of announcements. First, we have a donation bowl over on the counter. We encourage you to contribute to it. We split that with our speaker to further her work and also retain the other half to maintain this space for further such events. And, of course, the book is right there, and you can take a look at it. And I dare say a signature could even be inscribed therein. Do check that out and come see us again when all the shelves are not pushed back against the wall. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And would you be willing to, if you care, to be on my email list where I announce classes and things like that, and just